It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll learn all about animal hibernation here in Wisconsin, humans and others. First, Governor Walker announced a new set of proposals today aimed at making college more affordable for former, current, and future students. Speaking in Pewaukee and La Crosse, the governor pitched the plan as a way to build on the UW system tuition freeze over the last 4 years, which he said saved students thousands of dollars. The governor outlined 6 proposals aimed at making higher education more affordable, reducing student loan debt, and making the cost of school more transparent. The plans come at a time when graduates of Wisconsin universities face nearly $29,000 in debt on average. Here's what Governor Walker had to say about the proposals earlier this afternoon.
As a father, 2 sons in college, I can appreciate what families and students go through in this state. And for us, it's all about making sure that everyone who wants a job can find a job, and part of it's having access to higher education.
Joining us now with the details on the governor's proposal is WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach. He was at the first press conference today. Chuck, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, one of the proposals aims to eliminate a cap on tax deductions for student loan interest. So talk that out for us. What did the governor and, I guess, some legislators have to say about that?
Well, the governor is following up on some proposals authored by Republican legislators. He's endorsing them, I guess. And on the state tax deduction, right now there's a limit of how much you can deduct on student loans for the year, $2,500. He wants to get rid of the cap so that people could fully deduct their student loan interest. And the governor's office says the average benefit per tax filer that would fit into this category would be about $165, mainly people making between $32,000 and $70,000 a year. The governor's office says this would help 32,000 single and married filers in the state.
And you mentioned an important point here. This is all legislation that lawmakers would tackle, and they'd have to do it pretty fast because they're hoping to be out of here by February, right?
Well, that's the word, yes. They've got several proposals in line here, and the governor is sort of trotting some of them out in advance of his State of the State speech. He wanted to get the message out on education today, I guess.
Now, there's also ideas out there in this legislation and what the governor is promoting today to help current students and future students pay for college, some involving grants for technical college students. What does that legislation look like?
Well, it would increase an existing program that's needs-based, pump about $1 million more in, or over 2 years, that is, benefiting about 1,000 students at the technical colleges.
And there's a proposal also to create grants for students in emergency financial need who, I guess, have a financial hardship while they're in school, might not be able to complete?
Right. Again, UW students, but I think, and also to the technical college, 130,000 to the UW system college students, 320,000 to the technical college students, emergency grants to help a student finish his or her degree if they've got some sort of unfortunate situation. Again, if you add the number of all the students in the state, this is not a lot per student, but hopefully there's not a lot of emergencies out there.
Right. I mean, the amounts of money we're talking about held up against the overall UW system budget, the technical college budget, these are not huge amounts of money, it sounds like.
Well, I asked him a little bit about that, and he was calculating $6 million, maybe. I mean, there would be lost revenue, of course, if this tax deduction is increased or the cap is reduced. Another million to here. He didn't quite tabulate it, but somewhere $6, $7, $8 million. He says it's all paid for because the state has an estimated surplus, $136 million. He's not going to use all of that, of course, but he's talking about using a relatively small portion of it, says these proposals are funded.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach about proposed legislation promoted today by the governor related to college affordability, higher education affordability. Internships, another part of this, looking at brain drain, I think, here in the state. What happens there with what lawmakers are proposing?
2 positions, one at the Department of Workforce Development, as well as some additional funding for the UW system to work with employers and institutions to grow relationships to help students gain job skills.
And then finally, one that wouldn't reduce costs directly at all, or probably cost much, but an effort to help families and students make more informed decisions. What's in there about transparency of higher education costs?
Yeah, requiring all state institutions of higher ed to provide financial literacy to their students within the first semester of the instruction, requiring all institutions to offering an associate degree or higher to annually mail cost, loan, and other financial information to the students. Getting the word out, I guess, whether people would look at it is another question, but at least make it sure they're aware of what's out there.
Scott Ross from One Wisconsin Now, was in the vicinity today. He responded to the governor's proposals. Here's a clip from that statement.
So the governor talked about, peanuts in terms of a additional deduction, but nothing about what would make the biggest impact, and that is the ability to refinance your student loans just like you can a mortgage.
And this is something that state Democrats have proposed, allowing students or former students to refinance their student loan debt. That is not something that appears to be on the table with Republicans, Chuck.
No, the governor says that Connecticut, which is starting this up, the interest rates might actually be higher than what the federal loan program is. Ross denies this. He says the Connecticut program is just getting underway. Ross calls it a student loan crisis out there, that there's a million people with student debt. There's $19 billion in student debt in the state, and that the state should be doing more, including an authority to help refinance student debt. I don't think the banks would like some of that, or the other loan programs would like if people suddenly started taking more advantage of refinancing, but maybe.
So a number of pieces of legislation here, a clock ticking here. Is there a timetable for when we're going to see these things make progress in the legislature?
Well, certainly possible. I think compared to some of the more controversial things before the legislature right now, I don't know how high a priority this is, but Governor Walker suggests that Democrats would vote for some of these things because they would be steps towards helping students. Again, the debate is whether they'd be much of a help.
All right, we'll leave it there. Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach giving us the latest details on Governor Walker's plan to make college more affordable and some of the early response to the proposals he offered. Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans, not one of them, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not-so-unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. "She smells even worse than last year," one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. Now that the cold weather of winter is well and truly here, who doesn't love the idea of hunkering down and hibernating until the warmer temps return? Well, a lot of people like getting out there, I guess, even in the cold. Our next guest gets out in the cold. He's here to tell us exactly what happens when our brothers and sisters in the animal kingdom do just that. They hibernate. Here to talk about animal hibernation is David Drake, professor and extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me on again.
Well, spell out the basic strategies. Animals got to get through winter one way or another. What are their options?
Yep. So there's three main options for a species of wildlife. And we're talking about the northern climates where you have a seasonal shift in temperature and daylight and things like that. And so just think about Wisconsin, for example, in that type of a climate. So animals have three general ideas in mind. So one, they can just hightail the heck out of here and go south. So those are the animals that migrate, and primarily those are bird species that migrate going south.
And although, retirees.
Yeah, I was going to say, we do have snowbirds too, right? The retirees that are heading south as well. So that's one option. One option is to go into some form of torpor. And torpor is just defined as some kind of a controlled reduction in body temperature and metabolism. So you're actually going into some kind of a deep sleep, or the most extreme form of torpor is hibernation that we just heard about. And then the other option is that you don't go anywhere and you don't go into any form of torpor, but you are active year-round, and you're active and you stay in this climate through the winter. And so there's some strategies then that these animals have to employ if they're going to be active year-round, especially through the winter, because that typically is the most difficult time of the year on them, because they food sources are reduced, and obviously you have that cold weather, so they've got to combat that.
Let's key in on the hibernators now. So you gave us some of a almost technical definition of hibernation, but what's involved? What makes one thing hibernation, one thing just kind of going underground for a bit?
Yeah, so generally what drives all of this, whether the animals are going to migrate or they're going to hibernate or go into some form of torpor again, is the day length. And so the length of sunlight that we have, obviously, the shorter the days, the colder the temperatures, we have a different type of precipitation. So instead of rain, we might have snow and things like that. So the length of day is actually the large driver that tells animals, if you're going to head south, you better get going pretty soon, or if you're going to go into hibernation, you better get prepared for that. And so if animals are going to hibernate or go into some form of torpor, and there's variations of torpor. So some animals will go into a type of torpor where they'll reduce their body temperature, for example, at night when they sleep, and then they'll raise the body temperature back to a more active level during the day, for example. And so that's a variation of torpor. Again, the most extreme variation of torpor is hibernation, where the animal, like a bat, for example, or a groundhog, or also called a woodchuck, that they'll go into hibernation maybe, end of October, sometime in November, and then they'll just stay in hibernation through the entire winter until they come out of hibernation again sometime in the spring. And so what happens for all these animals is they've got to prepare by putting on some kind of fuel or extra calories. And so typically that's in the form of what's called brown fat. And brown fat is there's different types of fats, but brown fat is a fat that it burns easily, and it's one of the types of fat that these animals use to wake up. And so the benefit is that if you're going to go into torpor, you are actually reducing your body temperature so that your body temperature is just a few degrees above the ambient or air temperature. And by doing that, when you don't have as great a, so we're at 98.6 as human beings. Well, today it's 9 degrees. So we've got a 90-degree difference between our internal temperature and the outdoor temperature or the ambient temperature. And so that's a big difference that we have to maintain.
It costs us a lot to maintain that difference.
It costs us a ton of energy to maintain that difference, for sure. So if you're a species of wildlife and you can reduce your body temperature closer to the actual ambient temperature, there's not this large gradient, and you don't have to spend as much energy to do so. So when they're in hibernation, they're actually, they reduce their respiration, they reduce their heart rate, they reduce their metabolism, and by doing that, it allows them to save energy. So they'll pack on as much energy as they can prior to hibernation, and then they'll live off that fat or off that energy all winter long until it's time to wake back up. The animals that go into torpor, where they just lower their body temperature on a daily basis or a nightly basis, for example, then every time that they raise their body temperature, it costs them a lot of energy to do so. So they've got to really find a lot of food and replace that energy almost daily. Whereas, you know, a seasonal hibernator, they only have to survive through the winter, and they only have to use that very expensive energy once to wake back up in the spring.
Talking to wildlife specialist David Drake about hibernation and how Wisconsin wildlife makes it through the winter. So you kind of answered one thing for me there. I wonder sometimes, oh, wow, we had this really warm November, December. Mm-hmm. Does that throw anybody off? They don't know it's time to hibernate. You're saying no, it's the length of the day.
It's primarily the length of the day. Now, so what will happen, however, and I should also say there's other strategies going on here. So if you're a hibernator, for example, a lot of times you're hibernating in some kind of a sheltered area. So either you're under the ground, or if you're black bears are not, there's still some controversy out there, but they're most likely not true hibernators because they do wake up, or they're able to be woken up over the course of their hibernatory period. But for example, a bat, you know, bats go into a lot of times caves, and those caves are high humidity, and they stay a pretty constant temperature at 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's relatively warm in there. So they pick these microclimates where it also helps them not have to burn as much energy as if they were out in the wide open and this cold winter wind was blowing across them all the time. But what happens sometimes in the winter is that these animals also rely on snow and snow depth, because that snow provides a blanket of thermal protection. And so if you're a hibernator, especially if you're a hibernator beneath the ground or, you know, underground, and you don't have that blanket of snow to protect you thermally, you actually can lose heat very quickly, and you can burn through your fat reserves trying to stay warm. And so there are some things, like when we've had this very mild winter, the weather, the temperature was not terribly cold, but we also didn't have a lot of snowfall on the ground to help protect these animals.
So you've mentioned a few of the hibernators. Can you name some more names? Who among our neighbors out there is hibernating right
now? Yep. So typically it's smaller-bodied animals, because the smaller your body, the quicker you lose heat. There's this ratio between the amount of surface area, your skin that's covering your body, compared to the amount of heat-generating tissue. So your organs are constantly, as they're beating, they're also generating heat. But because you don't have a lot of skin around that, you lose that heat very quickly. So the smaller animals typically have some kind of a torpor strategy. So the jumping mice, we have a woodland and a field metal jumping mice. So they hibernate. Bats hibernate. Ground squirrels, woodchucks, things like that will typically hibernate.
I see a lot of rabbits. They like to munch on tree bark. Yep. I don't know, in my backyard.
Yep.
Only the ones I've paid money for. They're big enough. They don't have to hibernate, or do they do that partial torpor you were talking about?
Well, no. So rabbits, they also animals that are going to be active year round, for example. So you think about otter or mink or something like that. These animals are what we call fur bearer species. Well, they put on their coat becomes prime and it becomes very, very thick in the winter. So that if you're a trapper, that's why you trap in the wintertime, is because the coat is prime.
Oh.
So those animals have an extra thick coat. In the winter, it would be too thick for them. In the summer, they would overheat. Mm-hmm. And so rabbits put on a nice, they've got a nice thick coat, but they also eat a lot of food, and they have a relatively high metabolism that keeps that internal engine constantly churning. But they also have to feed that engine all the time, and so that's why they're eating your very expensive bark.
So I want to end with the bears. I have grown up assuming that bears hibernate. You say that's a controversy.
Well, they go into torpor. And the reason some people don't think they're true hibernators is like a bat. So a bat will go into hibernation, and they don't wake up until the springtime. Well, bears, the female bear, if she's pregnant, she'll give birth in the middle of winter, and they can be awoken if you go in and disturb them in their hibernatory den or wherever they might be. So they don't hibernate through the entire season like a true hibernator, like a groundhog or a bat would.
All right, that's all we have time for. David, thanks a lot for joining us. Really interesting.
Thank you.
And public service announcement, do not wake up that hibernating bear.
Don't wake up the bear.
It's David Drake. He's professor and extension wildlife specialist at UW-Madison. We've been learning about how our animal neighbors hibernate here in Wisconsin. A recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finds some startling news about how e-cigarettes are being marketed in the country and how they're reaching kids. The report finds that e-cig companies are reaching about 7 in 10 middle and high school students with their ads. That's more than 18 million young people altogether. In addition, the CDC says the themes used in those ads, things like sex, rebellion, independence, are the same themes used generations ago to hook young people on old-fashioned cigarettes. You can join in with your thoughts on e-cigarettes and kids. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Vince Wilmore joins us now. He's the Vice President of Communications at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Vince, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So this report from the CDC, ads for e-cigs reaching 7 out of 10 middle and high school kids. What was your reaction when that came out?
Well, we're very concerned about that, and we're especially concerned about the results of that, in that we've seen a huge increase in the number of kids using e-cigarettes. In fact, among high school students, the number of high school students using e-cigarettes tripled from 2013 to 2014. And now about 13.4% of high school students use e-cigarettes, which is even more than use regular cigarettes. And this has happened because e-cigarettes are completely unregulated. It's a Wild West market out there that tobacco companies have been able to use the same tactics that have always been used to market regular cigarettes to kids.
Right. A selling point of e-cigarettes was some smokers will use them to wean off of tobacco. Others will keep using them, but maybe it'll be less obnoxious to people around them. But the worry here, you're saying, is that they're a gateway way to get nicotine.
That's right. E-cigarettes could be a good thing if they're proven to be effective at helping regular current smokers give up regular cigarettes. But we don't want kids to start using any tobacco product, including e-cigarettes. And unfortunately, that's what we've seen happen with a huge increase in youth use of e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes contain nicotine, which is highly addictive, which we know is harmful to adolescent brain development, and it could lead to use of other tobacco products, including regular cigarettes.
What advertising restrictions exist now for cigarettes, as we used to think of them, and other tobacco products that aren't in place for e-cigarettes?
Sure. Right now, you can't advertise regular cigarettes on TV or on radio. In stores, they have to be kept behind the counter. There's no self-service display of cigarettes. Cigarettes are not allowed to sponsor auto races and music concerts, which like they used to do, and we'd like to see those same restrictions applied to e-cigarettes.
Are you hoping that those restrictions will go to e-cigarettes anytime soon? Is there any kind of movement on this?
Well, what we're working on right now is to get the FDA to begin regulating e-cigarettes. The FDA said first, way back in 2011, that they plan to regulate e-cigarettes. In April 2014, they finally issued draft rules. And the final rules finally went to the White House in November. So it's taken far too long, but we're calling on the White House to issue those rules as quickly as possible. And this new CDC study shows why that needs to happen.
Talking to Vince Wilmore from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids about e-cigarettes, advertising, and kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a young person, are you seeing these e-cigarette ads? Do you think they're looking for you to try their products? If you're a parent or if you're in the schools, are you seeing that as well? Call 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Vince, talk us through where those kids, those middle schoolers and high schoolers, are running into this marketing. What in particular has you worried that it might get them trying this product?
Well, e-cigarette companies are using the same marketing tactics that have long been used to make regular cigarettes glamorous and appealing to kids. They've got TV ads with celebrity endorsements from people like actor Stephen Dorff and Jenny McCarthy, the actress Jenny McCarthy. They're kind of the modern equivalent of the Marlboro Man and the Virginia Slims woman. They're also sponsoring auto races and music concerts. They've got ads in magazines like Rolling Stone and Sports Illustrated. One ad ran in the swimsuit issue of Sports Illustrated, and it put the logo of an e-cigarette right in the middle of a bikini. So you can imagine that ad is clearly aimed at teenage boys. In Florida, we even saw an e-cigarette ad on a billboard using Santa Claus. So these are very irresponsible tactics, and that's why we've seen such a big increase in youth use of e-cigarettes.
We'll go to a caller now. We've got Regina on the line in Milwaukee. Regina, hi. Regina? I don't think she's hearing me. She was concerned, she says, not just about nicotine, but oily vapors, other products, the flavoring particles in this. It may be more than just the nicotine that she's worried about as a health hazard. Just as with traditional cigarettes, it's more than the nicotine that people are worried about, Vince. Any thoughts on that?
Well, some studies have found that e-cigarettes do contain some harmful and even cancer-causing chemicals. While they may be present at lower levels than in regular cigarettes, they could still be harmful. And that's why we don't want kids using these products and why we need FDA to regulate these products.
So getting back to the messaging in these ads, you mentioned the Santa, the swimsuit ads in general. Are you seeing a lot of the advertisements out there for e-cigarettes? Maybe not super blatantly, but maybe with a wink and a nod, keeping kids in mind?
These ads are using the same themes that regular cigarettes have always used to appeal to kids. They present e-cigarette use as fun, sexy, glamorous, rebellious, and we know those themes appeal to kids.
So it's the all in the FDA's hands now, is that right? You're not looking for Congress or anyone else to take action, or could there be action at a state level?
There are things states can do. Most states have prohibited e-cigarette sales to kids. A growing number of states are adding e-cigarettes to their smoke-free laws, so e-cigarette use is prohibited in the same places where regular cigarettes are prohibited. Those are good steps. Congress actually took an important step today and required child-proof packaging for nicotine liquid that's used in e-cigarettes, because we've also seen a big increase and poisoning cases related to e-cigarettes. But the most important steps do require FDA regulation of e-cigarettes.
Let's try taking another caller. We've got Zach on the line in Door County. Zach, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I just think that, yes, I understand, like, people's worry about it, but it just seems more as in people just trying, the government trying to get in to regulate something to tax, to make revenue off something they don't have control over yet.
Zach, thanks for the call. Vince, any thoughts?
I think that our concern and the concern of most of the policymakers we're dealing with is to really to protect kids and to protect public health. It's not to raise revenue by taxing e-cigarettes. A few states have looked to do that, but the action with regard to taxing e-cigarettes has actually been very limited so far.
Vince, do you have thoughts for parents who might be concerned about this in the meantime while the FDA hasn't acted? Thoughts on what parents should be on the lookout for, what they should talk to their kids about?
Sure. Parents should be talking to their kids about the fact that while e-cigarettes may seem less harmful than regular cigarettes and have been portrayed that way, they still contain nicotine. They're very addictive. They can harm the developing adolescent brain. They could lead to use of more dangerous tobacco products. And kids should talk to kids about being smart consumers, about not being manipulated by the marketing for these products.
We'll leave it there for now. Vince, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate your interest.
That's Vince Wilmore. He's Vice President of Communications for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, talking about the reach of e-cigarette advertising to young people after a CDC report on that topic. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We woke up to sad news this morning with the passing of the legend, David Bowie. There's been reaction from music, musicians, fans, political and religious leaders from around the world and even beyond, with a tweet from astronauts on the space station. We want to hear from you, your thoughts on Bowie's career, musical legacy, your favorite songs. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jonathan Pollock joins us here in the studio now. John is a history instructor at MATC and one of our go-to guys on music and popular culture. John, good to talk to you again under sad circumstances.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back. Thanks for inviting me in.
So, David Bowie, I mean, I was just telling you, this is a big one for me. How about you?
Yeah, no, it's a pretty big one for me. I mean, I have to admit, I was not as huge a fan of his as some people. I mean, I didn't, I don't have like a lot of Bowie vinyl and so forth. But I was just thinking about it as I was waiting to come in here, that what really impressed me about him is that nowadays it's often hard to cover popular songs that people expect to go hear a band, and they often expect it to hear how it sounds like on the radio.
Uh-huh.
And what's great, one of the things I love about Bowie is that when I was thinking about Bowie songs through the day, what kept coming into mind were Bowie covers.
Yeah.
Were when Seu Jorge, the Brazilian musician, did a bunch of Bowie covers for the Life Aquatic soundtrack, and Kurt Cobain's Man Who Sold the World. And
Bauhaus did Ziggy Stardust.
Yeah, that they're just all these, and they're really different spins on it. I mean, they're very different bands, and they took the songs apart and they really made them their own. But what amazes me about Bowie is that in addition to being such an incredible performer and being like the consummate rock star, he was also like up there with one of the great popular music songwriters, that his music could be adopted so much and in so many different ways.
That's interesting.
Philip Glass did a treatment of Heroes like in the 90s. So he's his songwriting talent is just incredible. And for me, for friends I've talked to today who've been really sad about Bowie's passing, that's kind of what I said, is that, well, in addition to his own recorded legacy that survives, his songs are going to live on. I mean, he's, people 50, 100 years from now are still going to be performing David Bowie covers and performing them in whatever styles of music evolve during that time, because he's just that good.
And talking about music evolving over a time, this is a guy who was not stuck in the style he started in. He was... What I like to think of was David Bowie probably never said, these kids today, their music is terrible. Like he said, these kids today, what can I do with that? How can I write a song in that style?
It's another way he's really inspirational. I mean, for people who are I think I can say the two of us are out of the standard rock demographic, that we're not likely to get a big contract anytime soon.
Right.
But he's like a role model for you because he was always putting out new stuff. He changed his style. He was a huge collaborator with other cutting-edge musicians of the day. And that's one of the things that was really inspirational about him.
Talking to John Pollock about David Bowie's music and career. Want to hear from you. We're going to start playing some of the music in a minute. You can join in with your favorite Bowie song, favorite Bowie memory. Did you see him play? I was lucky enough to do that once back in Detroit, way back in the day. You can call in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Speaking of changes, one of my favorite albums was one from the late 90s, Earthling. And here's a song for that, Little Wonder.
Thinking weather, fans, shaking hands, darkly morning, dark grumpin' arms. Little wonder then, little wonder, you little wonder, you. Big screen dolls, kids and explosions, sleepy time, that's for the news.
So this is obviously a style that didn't hold over from his late 60s, early 70s classic rock era.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a great example because he's got that, it's that combination of that distinctive voice over something that sound that's from a much more recent time. That, yeah, it's proof of how he kept up with music as it changed and was always exploring new things.
He just released a new album a few days ago, actually, and I haven't listened to it yet. I don't know if you have. It's on my to-do list.
Yeah, no, I haven't listened to it either. Initially I was really confused this morning because I saw this, there was publicity about the new record coming out, and it was just his birthday a couple days ago. And then I saw this Bowie stuff this morning, and I thought, well, okay, a little late. And then I realized, no, wait a minute, he just died. Mm-hmm. So, literally right up until the end, he was coming out with new stuff and always experimenting and always creating.
We heard from Aaron on Facebook who says, I have the best memories of David Bowie as the Goblin King in Labyrinth. She's quoting, dance, magic, dance. I never saw Labyrinth. But Bowie also, actor, The Hunger, actually.
Yeah. Yep.
Wonderful movie for the right crowd.
He did some really interesting movie work between those two and Year of Living Dangerously. We did the soundtrack, of course, his movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth, where he was really the center of it. The presence that he had on stage really translated to screen really well. He was a great kind of, supporting actor, to kind of put him in there. He just always looked like he was in all these very different kinds of roles that he was just having a great time.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234 as we talk about David Bowie's music and career. We've got Sherry on the line in Whitewater. Sherry, hi.
Hi there. I loved David Bowie. He, from the Spiders from Mars from way back when. I grew up in the Detroit area and saw him several times, a big group of us. He was so incredibly talented.
Sherry, any favorite songs or favorite performances since you saw more than one?
Oh, man, that's a long time ago.
Pick.
I'm old. I loved them. His CDs, the albums have been replaced by CDs. Mm-hmm. They're still in my collection, and I still listen to them. He was a really talented guy.
Sherry, thanks a lot for that call. The show I saw was a tour where it was like, okay, guys, this is the last time I'm going to play my old stuff and move on to the new stuff. He's a guy, John, who could have just kept playing the old stuff
and people
would have been happy, and he wasn't going to be content to stay there.
Yeah, no, he was. I mean, I remember when he came out with the Let's Dance record in the 80s, which is kind of a comeback. He hadn't recorded much before, in a few years before that. One of the things I just remembered about the Let's Dance record was the song Modern Love, which was one of my favorite David Bowie songs. And it's got, Modern Love has this baritone sax solo on it. And my dad's a saxophone player, and he has a Barry sax. And it actually inspired me, and I wanted him to teach me how to play saxophone so I could do that solo. It was just great.
Here's a little bit of Modern Love. Sorry, John, I didn't go long enough to get all the sax
in there. It's not Bowie playing the solo. So
but he was
totally
a saxophonist to begin with, and it seems like saxophone keeps appearing, I guess, even on the new album.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, you're right. His stuff does have a lot of saxophone
David Sanborn on Young Americans.
Yeah. No, he, and Sanborn's proof that when he had studio musicians working with him, he was able to command the best in the business.
Stevie Ray Vaughan playing a lot on this album, actually, on other tracks. Yeah. Let's go to another caller. We've got Colleen on the line in Eau Claire. Colleen, hi.
Hi there. I was just calling to say one thing. I love David Bowie, and
when I was 16 and just got my driver's license, I had the tape of, I think, his greatest hits or something, and I was playing Young American so loud in the car. The cop that pulled me over for speeding said that he was following me for like a mile and a half, and I didn't pull over. I was just so excited about going on the radio.
Well, hopefully you calmed down after that, Colleen, but you you stayed a Bowie fan even after that experience, I hope?
Yeah, I love it. Great, classic, awesome music. Such a talent.
Colleen, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. John, we also heard from Sarah Jean on Facebook. She picked one of the ones you had suggested playing, Under Pressure. This is David Bowie with Queen. We'll give a listen.
It's a terror of knowing what this world is about.
So I picked that a little bit because you've got the contrast between two, I mean, unreplicatable voices of rock and roll, Freddie Mercury and David Bowie.
Yeah, and it's just another example how Bowie just kind of went and collaborated with lots of people that, you know, and this was just a one-off, and this was the one song they did together. Mm-hmm. I find it a song that's incredibly poignant, incredibly sad to listen to because it's about the beginnings of the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, it came out like in 81 when nobody knew what was going on. A lot of people in Bowie's circle of friends and, of course, Freddie Mercury himself were dying of this disease that no one knew what it was and nobody seemed particularly troubled to go search it out. And you're left with a song that's just a really moving historical document of that particular point in time in the early 80s.
Take another caller now. John is with us in Menominee Falls. John, hi.
Hello. I remember, back in 73 or 74, I know he had the Diamond Dog Tour in 1974, November. He was in Nashville. But prior to that, I know he played in Nashville because I went down with some of my friends, Jim and some other guys that I was in the military with down at Fort Jumbo, Kentucky. Drove down to Nashville and we saw the plays. Spider from Mars concert, and it was just amazing some of the outfits he came out with. And I remember having that 8-track. I used to play the Living Daylights out of it. Later on, I remember hearing Vet Stance and China Dolly, I believe it was, with Stevie Ray Vaughan. Just amazing musician.
John, thanks for that call. And he mentioned those outfits, androgynous, interspecies, almost inhuman outfits sometime. David Bowie was doing some of this stuff before it was cool, John.
Yeah, no, he was a real pioneer in that area. I mean, it seems like he just liked to blur boundaries. The boundaries between man and woman, between film star and rock star, between human and extraterrestrial, that he just really liked being in that kind of ambiguous state. And I think that's where a lot of his fans came from. He was a fascinating character to kind of mix things up that people weren't thinking of.
The favorite track for you, John?
Hard
to pick just one.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, we've talked about, I think I mentioned Ziggy Stardust, Under Pressure. Heroes is way up there. Suffragette City. How many want me to go?
That's the thing. And people say ones that I keep saying either, oh yeah, that's a great one, or oh my god, his catalog's so deep, I didn't even know that one in some cases. And I'm a fan. I'm like really upset today about his passing. Well, John, thank you so much for coming to talk about David Bowie with us.
Thanks for inviting me in. It's great to be here.
It's Jonathan Pollock with Madison College. You can still share your Bowie memories over at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Barrett. Veronica Rickert's out today. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Take a play.